Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Not in studio, broadcasting live, but we're doing a lot of filming. In fact, earlier this week, filmed in Denmark. And over the next 4 months, we'll be completing principal photography on my newest feature film and the most difficult film that I've ever took the helm of. But I think when it's all done and ready for broadcast about a year from now, it'll make an important contribution to self-empowering people on important issues. It'll be under wraps until that time. Today, the latest on health and healing. Exposure to common flame retardants may contribute to attention problems in children, Columbia University. Ohio State University, metabolic syndrome. That's a lot of Americans suffer from that, probably 100 million. You need more vitamin E. Also, how to have healthier hair. I'll give you the latest on that as well, and a lot more on health and healing. From our environmental segment today, global warming can alter the shape of the planet as melting glaciers erode the land. From the University of British Columbia, there's just one line from this Nature magazine piece that I think is very revealing and not a word in the mainstream media. I'll tell you what that one line is. Also from Michael T. Clare from Tom Dispatch, welcome to a new planet. Climate change's tipping points. Do you remember 8 years ago when I began a whole series on the tipping points? Well, we're no longer in a nonlinear climate shift. In fact, we're in singularities. We are tipping. I'll explain what this means to the people living around the world. Remember the movie The Day After Tomorrow with Dennis Quaid? It was a 2004 climate disaster movie, most notable for its vivid scenes of a frozen over New York City. Well, our melting polar ice causes a disruption in the North Atlantic Current. We are now seeing that happen, but I'll go more into that in that discussion. My guest in the second part of our program, talking about what neuroscience teaches us about mapping our minds for self-transformation, is Dr. Louis Malmaldrone. He is a physician and a professor, and we'll have a discussion on that. Also time today, as many of you are aware, because I've received a lot of emails, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is done. It is complete. They've agreed upon it. Now, all the countries have to sign off on it. It'll be given to the president, and because he was already given permission to fast-track it, it'll be an up-and-down vote. And that means that we had better understand what's in it, and we really have to put our attention behind this. So today, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Economic Treaty, is the calling card for death of the United States as a sovereign nation. And I'm not going to talk to the Republicans, the conservatives today at all. This is for those who thought they were bright enough to be liberal. If you think you're bright, you think you're aware, you think you're tuned in, well, what do you have to say about the New World Order? Oh, and by the way, one of your favorites, runs the Nation magazine, is a part of that. From Global Research, Hagopian, you'll hear about that. Also today, we'll take a look at some other things that are little audio clips that I like to play that give us some insight on what's happening. Let's begin. We now know that there are more than 80,000 chemicals, human-made chemicals, in the environment, none of which have ever been tested for their long-term impact on human health in combination with any other ingredient. The trouble is there's no single chemical that we're exposed to by itself. In our food or in our clothing, or in our furniture, our carpets, in our detergents or shampoos, it's always a multitude of chemicals. According to Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, quote, prenatal exposure to some fire retardants that have been widely used in consumer products is associated with a tension problem in children ages 3 through 7. That's according to the newest study published in the journal Neurotoxicology and Teratoxicology. Now, where do we get these? We get these chemicals in textiles, plastics, wiring, furniture containing polyurethane foam to reduce flammability. And since these are not bound chemically to these materials, they migrate, they move into the environment over time. Humans are commonly exposed to the chemicals through accidental ingestion of house dust, eating meat, dairy, fatty fish, because they have accumulations of these PBDEs, these polybromylated diphenyl ethers. These are really bad. They're very toxic, and they're virtually ubiquitous. Now, researchers followed 210 mother-child pairs, and what they found in this study is that the cord blood samples were analyzed, and these people have the chemical in their body, and they end up with a greater likelihood of having problems with their neurodevelopment, meaning your child would not do well in testing. Your child's IQ might be affected. All these things can make a difference. So what do we do? First, as much as humanly possible, pay attention to the things that you have in your home. Get rid of carpets, unless they're all natural. Better to have wood floors, hardwood floors, not particle wood floors. And you can seal them to protect them using an oil, a natural oil. Glass is good. Get rid of aluminum cookware. Get rid of all of the bedding that is not organic and natural. Ideally, have a mattress. I sleep on a mattress that is made out of bamboo. It breathes. It allows the body's moisture to be evaporated. And it has natural antimicrobial, antifungal properties. Because when people are sleeping, what is happening is that the body is exfoliating dead cells, generally on the back and the legs, because that's where most people sleep, on their back. But then when you're moving in bed, in effect, you're giving yourself a little loofah scrub. And that's exfoliating. So those are dead cells. Those are oils, sebum, and the sebaceous glands. So your body is expelling toxins from your cells all night long. Those end up on your sheets, on towels that you use, on pillows. Now, ideally, you should be able to sleep without a pillow. I never sleep with a pillow. I haven't slept with a pillow since I was a kid. It's much healthier, much better for breathing, much better for your neck alignment. But we've all gotten used to these stupid pillows, and these stupid pillows contain chemicals, especially the foams, and those can hold these, unless you have it one selected that does not, which is certainly possible, but you have to look for it, you're going to end up with these chemicals. So you're breathing them all night long. Now your body's temperature is heating up the pillow, heating up the sheets. So if you use bleach in your sheets, bad idea, never use bleach in cleaning. Disinfecting, yes, but sleeping on something with bleach, no, that's going to irritate your skin. That can cause contact dermatitis and cause rashes, and it's not healthy to breathe that. Instead, always put a little lemon concentrate in your wash. That's a good disinfectant. And use clear detergent, biologically biodegradable, with no fragrances at all, because more likely than not, the fragrance in that softener or detergent has chemical additives. So this way you get yourself chemically clean. And then anything that can give off gassing, for example, desks, cupboards, over time, I realize for a lot of people you can't do it all at once, but try to replace these. Even if you took all of your cupboard doors off, that's healthier and safer than having cupboards made out of particle wood, and the particle wood is outgassing on your plates. And this way you can keep yourself clean and you can keep it organized and you see what you have. These are just some thoughts. But let's say that your kid already has some learning disabilities, and you don't know, is it because something from the environment? Was it vaccines? What was it? You should start a detoxification program, especially between the ages of 2 and 7. Detoxifying with fruits, especially the berries, pomegranates, blueberries, bilberries, black currants are at the top of your list, and tart cherries for detoxifying. Then probiotics 3 times a day from non-dairy sources. Then methylated B12 and methylated folic acid, generally 1 milligram. And then cabbage juice once a day. And green apple with cabbage is also good, with celery is great, and lemon is terrific. Keep them away from any processed carbohydrate, the white flour products, bagels, buns, muffins, bread. If they want bread, give them sprouted bread that comes from 100% sprouts, so therefore it's gluten-free. Essene bread, E-S-S-E-N-E, is your best. Give them a lot of raw foods. If they want a snack, give them a raw cracker. It's healthy. It's just been dehydrated, but it has all the nutrients intact because it was dehydrated at 110 to 120 degrees. So that's good. And they even have them seasoned with natural oregano and natural rice cheese that's non-dairy, that is baked right into the drying process at 115 degrees. So it tastes like a pizza, but it's all good. There's nothing wrong with it. And kids can at least not feel that somehow they're being punished or deprived of something they may have been using. So you start to cleanse the system. Then get yourself in the hands of a holistic nurse, a holistic dietitian, a holistic physician, holistic dentist, holistic nutritionist, who can help guide you with all the other things you can do to help your child. Now, from Ohio State University comes a good study that shows that for the people suffering from metabolic syndrome, first, and that's about 1/3 of all Americans. So we've got a lot of people, about 104 million Americans suffering from some form of metabolic syndrome. Stay away from cow's milk. That's not good. And also take more vitamin E, because with metabolic syndrome, you absorb less vitamin E. That's something new that we didn't know. Therefore, and by the way, just I don't want to assume everyone in this audience knows things I've taught in the past, because we're getting new listeners every day. So metabolic syndrome is if you have 3 of 5 factors that increase the risk of heart disease or diabetes. For example, if you have excess belly fat, if you have elevated blood pressure, if you have the low HDL, which is actually the good cholesterol, but it's low, if you have high blood glucose levels and high triglycerides, and if you have that, then you're far more likely to have a heart attack or stroke or cancer. So now we have this study that shows that, quote, the fact that people with metabolic syndrome had lower bioavailability of vitamin E was expected, but had never been studied before, and therefore we had no guidance to make recommendations for that population. And that's according to the professor of human nutrition at Ohio State University, led a study. So here's my takeaway message on this. I would suggest that if you have metabolic syndrome or heart disease or diabetes, that you take a good quality mixed tocopherol with mixed tocotrienol together, and about 400 units twice a day. And finally, for those of you who are looking to have healthier hair, well, it's a lot of it has to do with how many superfoods you put in your system, because that rejuvenates. Now, historically, we were told you cannot change a genetic predisposition. They were absolutely right until I did it in a study of 1,500 people in this audience, and then we created a new right, a new paradigm. But it meant that we had to exceed the genetic expression. Hence, I came up with a concept called compensation, meaning to the degree that you have anything that limits you, anything at all, and this is a metaphor for life, you have to exceed that in order to not be limited. And one of the pleasures I get in life is seeing people get healthy. I love the fact that people who have never done a marathon one day, after 6 months of training, finish and have that big smile when they put that medal, which they do with everyone who finishes a marathon, around your neck. You've really achieved something. You have pushed back all the barriers of your conditioning. You're not competing with anyone except your former self that didn't believe you could do it. Or when I see a Queenie Thompson or Thelma Wilson, these are some great athletes. And recently passed Louise Nottage, who died in an accident, but she was the greatest senior athlete in world history. There's no woman in the history of sports on the planet that ever achieved what she did. She started with the Natural Living Running and Walking Club. In fact, every race that she would win, she would win. Everywhere in the world, she was unstoppable, but she was also one of the most beautiful souls you'd ever want to meet, kind and thoughtful and generous to a fault. And it's always that pleasure when you see someone finishing. Just 3 weeks ago, her first race in her life, watching as Eutrice Lead not only was not in the ground from her terminal cancer of the uterus and lungs, but she had just finished the championship down in Florida, what is called the 1 hour postal race. And you can't believe that the smile on her face. I mean, her smile was from ear to ear. And they gave her that medal. And she said, I've never raced before in my life. But she'd been training for not being able to shuffle. I mean, her feet couldn't even shuffle 10 feet to being out there for 12 miles until she had blisters. And she says, Gary, I got blisters. I says, okay, good, good. What do you mean good? Well, it's just, what do you think is going to happen? When you're training hard, you're going to have things hurt. You're going to get blisters. All athletes do. It's okay. They'll heal. Soak them in salt water. Massage in some coconut oil with some olive oil. And but now her hair is starting in. She's lost almost 78 pounds. And her oncologist said last week that all of the metastasis around her uterus, it's all gone. There's the tumor, but it's encapsulated. And that she could have done with surgery. And now in her lung, the same thing. They don't understand it. They can't figure it out. But it's wonderful to see when someone crosses a finish line and you see the smile on their face. Lights up your life. So that's the compensation that I'm talking about, where you didn't think you could do something. Maybe you're too sick, you're too old, you're not interested, but one day, for whatever reason, you put your mind to it and you do it. And you compensated for all the no's, I can'ts, not now's, or the genetic predisposition. And suddenly people had hair who didn't. So you got to understand, you got to go heavy upon the phytonutrients. The green vegetables, very important for hair growth. The fruit concentrates and polyphenols important. Coconut oil is important, both taking it internally and massaging it in at night. Also, you got to get the quality plant-based protein. I notice a lot of people don't appreciate that the hair follicle is made up of anywhere from 65 to 95% keratin. Kera, K-E-R-A, 10, T-I-N. And that's composed of amino acids, the building blocks of protein. And a rule of thumb for protein intake is consume 1 gram per kilogram of body weight today. So if you weigh 120 pounds, you'd want 54 kilograms, or you would need about 54 grams of protein a day. But if you're sick, if you're pregnant, if you've had surgery, if you have heavy metal toxicity, you'll need more. And a lot of people are just consuming meat. That is not the best form of protein. But beans and nuts and seeds are. Now, for those of you who are not allergic to dairy, and those of you who are not vegan, then whey protein, if it is from organic milk that has been fully tested and you've been tested to see you're not allergic to the casein in it, it's a good quality protein. In fact, for people with life-challenging illnesses, including advanced AIDS, I'll frequently see that they get a whey protein shake twice a day because it's really good for their body. but also split pea protein, brown rice protein, is also important too. Generally 20 grams three times a day. Then also get your B-complex, particularly biotin, impantothenic acid, and inositol, inos, I-N-O-S, etol, I-T-O-L, and panthenol, which is a precursor to pantothenic acid, is really good. And the tocotrienols, I mentioned those earlier, toco, T-O-C-O, tri, T-R-I, enols, E-N-O-L-S, toco, tri, enols. That's four components of the eight forms of vitamin E, and those give you thicker hair when you take them internally. And iron also is important. And if you're eating your beets and beet juices and your green vegetables, you're getting your iron. And so those are some of the easy things to do, and exercise. But remember, medications can cause hair loss. Stress can cause hair loss. Pregnancy, hair loss. Menopause, hair loss. Hormone imbalances due to alcohol consumption, hair loss. And men with androgenic alopecia, with its characteristics bald spot, that's almost always genetic, but you can treat it. And Rogaine actually is one of the, which is minoxidil. That is applied topically, and that has had some success for androgenic alopecia. But then you also have to look at, they have a little cap out there, and you wear the cap twice a day for 20 minutes, and it pulses little tiny lights, little laser lights. It's non-toxic, but it can stimulate the hair follicle to release an oil that helps sustain and cause the hair to grow thicker. So those are some things to help you with hair loss. And we've had great success. And if you look at my photographs, that's all me. And everyone in my family's bald, because I also had male pattern baldness. I just exceeded the limitation of it, and hence some good results. And by the way, JR, art director, came across a bunch of photographs that John Q from a running and walking club gave him. And what he did, he selected, I don't know, maybe 65, 70 photographs entitled Gary Training and Racing Over the Last 35 Years. And they're up on my Facebook page. And as of today, they'll be posted on Progressive Radio Network page. And what I found fun looking at them was all the people that brought back memories of training with those people over the years. Some wonder, I'm guessing there's 500 people, 1,000 people in these photographs. In one talk we had, I remember the talk, it was 700 people in the radio audience showed up on a Sunday morning to train for the marathon, and you see that picture. You don't see all the people, you see a lot. So you might want to go and see if you can find yourself over the last 35 years in training, and then see some of them racing. And the latest one was just 2 weeks ago. That photograph was taken at the state championship down in Florida, where I won overall in all age groups in the postal 1 hour race. And look forward, I'm racing 12 times next, starting in January. So I'm looking for a new year of training and racing. And if people want to know why aren't you looking as old as you should be chronologically, it's because I work on it. How about that? How simple is that? You work on keeping into shape. You watch what you eat, you drink, you think, and stay away from negative people, toxic people, or drama queens. Try that and see how much better you feel and how much better your biochemistry is, because the environment you're in, the EPA, impacts your genes, epigenetics. So if you're around good people, a good environment, positive, supportive, your genes go into an on mode for healing, rejuvenation, and positive energy. If you're around negative people, blaming people, toxic people, your genes actually go into an off position when it comes to supporting your immune system. So when I tell you that stress kills, and being around stressful people, drama people, really kill you, it's not worth it. It isn't worth it. There's too many wonderful, beautiful, loving people in this world. Who was it? Nina Simone, who said that when love is no longer served at the table, excuse yourself. Yeah, I agree with that. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
penso che un sogno così non ritorni mai più. Mi dipingevo le mani e la faccia di blu. Poi d'improvviso venivo dal vento rapito e incominciavo a volare nel cielo infinito. Volare, oh, cantare, oh, nel blu dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù. E volavo, volavo felice, più in alto del sole ed ancora più su. Mentre il mondo pian piano spariva lontano laggiù. Una musica dolce suonava soltanto per me. Volare.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to share a little bit about the Trans-Pacific Partnership because in all the news media, from the New York Times to the Washington Post, I've been reading what they are saying, and they are all reporting the pro-administration position that it's a good thing. It is not. It is a terrible thing. And I believe, as Joachim Agpoyan says, that it is the calling card for death of the United States as a sovereign nation. After 5 years of a negotiation this week in Atlanta, the trade ministers from all 12 nations finally arrived at an agreement to the biggest economic treaty in U.S. history. And co-opting their master's Trans-Pacific Partnership after hashing out their final bones of contention and then bringing what many consider, what I consider, this so-called New World Order, meaning one ruling body, one group of people, one organization of thought from individuals who all believe that we are incapable as individuals, as counties, as cities, as states, as governments, as nations, to rule our own lives. They believe, in their own hubris and arrogance, that they know best. Now, they may be right. But what if they're wrong? And remember, these are the people who've gotten us into all of our wars, from Vietnam and all of our destabilizations of all democratic governments, all sovereign governments that we have done. They have supported dictatorships, from Pinochet to Egyptian's dictator. So on more cases than not, they have always been wrong. But then you look at, how did this happen? How did they get it fast-tracked in Congress? Simply, they bribed the U.S. senators to vote in favor by 65-33 margin with a carrot stick sum of $1,140,971 in a three-month period this year when the bill was debated on the floor. This sadly is how business as usual gets done in Washington. Meanwhile, citizens' movements that bring pressure to bear on national governments to protect the people and the environment are rendered defenseless amidst the onslaught of corporatized dominance over nations and their populations. Let me just give you an example of why you should be against the Trans-Pacific Partnership and all the legislators and the president, everyone else that is for it. The Philip Morris Tobacco Company is suing Uruguay for imposing health warnings on cigarette packaging. A Canadian mining company is taking El Salvador to court due to citizens' grassroots efforts to halt mining operations from pouring poisonous chemicals into the ground to extract gold. So if the Trans-Pacific Partnership is passed, governments will no longer be able to protect its citizens, and any democratic rights of the people will be completely destroyed. If the fate of humans is to somehow avoid this totalitarian horror and nightmarish tyranny of a fascist one-world government, then the time to stand up and be counted is now. Citizens of the 12-nation Pacific Rim that includes U.S., Canada, Mexico, as well as Chile and Peru, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Malaysia, Singapore, Vietnam, Brunei, must demand that their government representatives refuse to pass this. And otherwise, it's going to happen. It was last year that I announced on this program that Princeton Northwestern University study officially declared the United States an oligarchy after determining that Congress operates on behalf of the ruling elite that pours billions into political pockets, effectively bribing them off to vote for its self-interest rather than the American people who voted them into office. But despite the rigged political system stacked against American citizens and this same blatant in-your-face corruption perversely entrenched now in virtually every nation on earth, it is up to we, citizens of the world, to ultimately band together in solidarity in order to make sure that this Trojan horse of a Trans-Pacific Partnership does not become law. Now, regardless of what happens, the 21st century has grown to where it is now recorded as the age of global deception and where everything is Orwellian doublespeak. And that is unfortunate. So all you have to do is do a little history. When you look at Jekyll Island conspiracy in 1910, the globalist bankers achieved their first coup d'etat in Washington when they snuck through Congress another bill, one no one read, just prior to Christmas recess 1913. That was the Federal Reserve. Then just at 2002's Patriot Act subsequently undermined and destroyed the U.S. Constitution from being upheld and practice as Americans' rule of law. The two most subversive pieces of legislation in U.S. history effectively destroyed the United States as a democratic republic. The deceitfully privatized Federal Reserve Act of 1913 and the unconstitutional Federal Income Tax Act of 1913. Now, in their third attempt at establishing for good a central banking system within America, the globalists adopted the same economic system that had been operating with the money of the ruling elite, mainly the Rothschilds, but other families, since the Bank of England began in 1694. And no sooner did the Wall Street bankers wield power over the U.S. government, seizing control over America's money supply, usurping the function of the U.S. Treasury, they were able to lock in an unconstitutional financial system whereby they were handed authority to create money out of thin air in order to charge interest on loans to the U.S. government, so wars that bankers actually cause could be conveniently financed at a handsome profit. Additionally, the globalist bankers were able to bludgeon both commercial businesses and private citizens with usury debt through interest accruing on bank loans, also cut out of thin air. And then with the annual collection of America's federal income tax used to pay off mostly the government's interest on war loans, the bankers have manipulated both Congress and Americans into their elaborate Ponzi scheme of a feudal debtor system. And just months later, the only thing left in 1914 was the immediate plunge Allied nations into the First World War against a globalist fundamentalist militarized Germany, always ensuring major dividends from war profiteering by financing, as they always do, both sides of a conflict. Thus, they ended up killing true free trade and instead created market manipulation with cartels of overriding monopolies and a handful of elitist families. You know, the Fords, the Carnegies, the Mellons, the Morgans, the Rothschilds, even the Bushes. And they proceeded to make killings off the blood, sweat, and tears of the American population in sacrificing our fallen soldiers for obscene profiteering while turning the rest of us still alive into the robotic walking dead sentence to a lifetime of indentured servitude. And if you doubt me on that, take a look at how much the average college graduate with a master's degree who doesn't have work in their field is owing, and the fact that they could not get out of that. They could not get that through bankruptcy. They got to pay it. If they can't pay it, then they could go to debtor's prisons. And even to seize more control over Washington's foreign policy, in particular guaranteeing virtual nonstop war by globalist design. In 1921, the elite's most public face, credited as the NWO Architects, was born in the Council on Foreign Relations. Over this last century, nearly every Secretary of State, every Secretary of Defense, and over 50% of all U.S. presidents have been card-carrying members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And after all, war has always been most profitable to globalist bankers, and hence it's no accident that 93% of the time as a nation, the U.S. has been killing other humans somewhere on the planet. 222 of its 239 years in existence, no other nation on earth can dare boast such dubiously shameful bragging rights. So through nearly 2.5 centuries of nonstop war, the neocons have won. The Project for a New American Century, in my personal opinion, a demonic agenda, has become reality. They've taken down America and its constitutional freedoms as the world's strongest nation by overextending its fighting war machine, decimating its middle class, and in effect destabilizing every nation and region on earth by manufacturing a permanent war of global terror, an unsustainable global economy driven by a gluttonous military-industrial complex, and establishing their own New World Order, tumultuously operating under public radar behind U.S.'s empire full-spectrum dominance on their geopolitics chessboard. After all, when the richest 1% of the global population is able to steal so much wealth that they actually own more than the rest of the world's 40 population, then that tells you these are very bright people and very successful at what they do. So this Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, these are just part of their schemes. Just one more way to make sure that there won't be a union left, there won't be any rights left, there won't be any place you can turn to once these corporations begin their raping of America. And it will happen, mark my words. Don't take my word for it, though. Look at what WikiLeaks managed to intercept. Limited portions of the Trans-Pacific Partnership became a glimpse of its ambitions to codify New World Order into supreme law, and some of the concealed fine print spells a foreboding blueprint for setting back both human rights and workers' rights and plunging us into another dark age feudalism. And so I believe that all unions should protest this, and I believe the only way you're going to stop this, the only way, is if all the unions in the United States, teachers' unions, all unions, joined together and went on general strike and voted out of office every single person that votes for this and shame this presidency. If you don't do that, it will pass. And you won't notice it immediately, but in time you will. Just like DDT and dioxin and Agent Orange, and just like all the other chemicals we've been exposed to, and cigarette smoking, and sugar, and saccharin, and electromagnetic pulses, just like all the things we were told are safe, were in our benefit, and don't be a pessimist, and don't talk negatively about it, the vaccines and everything else that are complete frauds, the day comes when you finally wake up and you say, what happened? Well, my friend, you weren't alive, you weren't awake, you were a zombie. And that's unfortunate. But there was someone far wiser than us today who warned us. We just didn't pay attention. Yesterday I gave you the talk of John F. Kennedy. Now I want you to hear from a former president, Dwight Eisenhower. Here's what he had to say.
Message of leave-taking and farewell.
This speech did not get very much attention. When a new president is coming to power, as John Kennedy was, the spotlight was not on Dwight Eisenhower.
We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions.
There was a feeling at the time that this must have been written by some speechwriter who just sneaked into the speech.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
3 months ago, we got contacted by a family up in Minnesota saying that we have documents from Malcolm Moose. He was responsible in part for drafting the military-industrial complex speech.
These new papers give us written evidence that this was not just some caprice of Eisenhower's or something by some speechwriter.
You see the evolution of his speech from May 1959 to 1961.
And he wanted to give this speech for a long time, 2 years.
Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea.
There was one person in Dwight Eisenhower's life whom he really confided almost everything to, and that was his brother Milton.
There's one particular document where the speechwriters had already drafted their version of his speech, only to see Milton come along and totally revamp what had already been written.
When Milton Eisenhower was taking notes and writing things on the drafts of these speeches, the speechwriters knew that it wasn't Milton talking, it was Ike.
The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
He would see magazines with advertisements for some, you know, new warplane or some bomb, and he got so angry he'd take the magazine and throw it into the fireplace of the Oval Office because he felt that defense spending should not be something that would be encouraged by companies who are seeking commercial gain.
We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
There is an interesting document. It shows that the farewell speech would be made to Congress. But yet, President Eisenhower decided, no, he was going to address the people.
Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
One test of how well a president speaks is how long the speech lives. Here we are 50 years later, we're still talking about this speech.
Now, on Friday noon, I am to become a private citizen. I am proud to do so. I look forward to it. Thank you, and good night.
So you see, two presidents back to back warned of secret societies. John F. Kennedy spoke about that specifically, and Eisenhower about the military-industrial complex. Well, both of them are one and the same today, with hundreds of front groups, and these groups are the ones that you see always going forward, giving their message in newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, all the networks. And so where then do we get an objective insight? That's why I'm warning you now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership will end America's freedom as we know it, and then we cannot appeal it. You cannot have, our Supreme Court is completely impotent to do anything about these corporations raping America, and they will, with the full knowledge and the full support of everyone who supported this treaty. This is demonic. This is evil. I'm Gary Nall. In a moment, my guest to talk about what neuroscience teaches us for mapping our minds for self-transformation. But I just want to mention that I'm going to save my comments about global warming and the tipping points for tomorrow. But tomorrow evening, we're going to have a wonderful opportunity to see something that will both inspire you, frighten you, anger you, and hopefully empower you. It is my new film, which won't be released for another 2 months. Then it'll be on some public television stations around the United States. It is called Saving the Planet. I'm showing it at 7 o'clock as a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI in New York City. And I'm looking forward to it. When you come, you're going to see the film. You're going to get a copy of the film to take home with you. And I'm going to have a pre-publication book, The Healthy Vegetarian. And The Healthy Vegetarian is 700 pages about healing yourself and healing the planet. I've interwoven a complete understanding of the tipping points, the environment, what we do to contribute to the problem, and most importantly, what we can do to reverse these problems and be accountable to ourselves. And it's a powerful book. It took years for me to research and write this book. And you're getting the first copies. The Healthy Vegetarian is a massive book, and I haven't written a book on the environment since Clearer, Cleaner, Safer, Greener, Blueprint for New Environment, which helped kick off Earth Day. And so it's a long time coming, but it's time now that you knew a lot more about the environment than what you've ever known before and what to do about it. The governments of the world will not solve the problem. They can't, because they're so corrupt, and the special interest groups that control factories that are polluting and fossil fuel industries have too much involved. They're not going to lose money, but they can give promises. You can go to these stupid, worthless, meaningless, insane, and fraudulent conferences they have at the UN and other little crappy organizations around the world. And I don't like the UN for what it's doing. It's been completely compromised at every level. Every level. In fact, by the way, here's something for you. And why don't you see if I'm right? See if there's not a CIA agent that monitors everything that goes on at the UN. That's something that was told to me by a high-ranking person at the UN. So when people say, well, we want global warming to be addressed, of course you do. And we want to see a sustainable future, of course you do. But what are you going to do about it? We're going to do nothing, but we'll keep having these conferences, and you'll keep broadcasting them live, and all these people will say, well, we made some progress. No, you didn't, and you weren't intended to. So it's up to us, we the people, individually and collectively, to make a change. Can we? Yes, we can. But you got to have the facts. You have to have the information. And the book, The Healthy Vegetarian, gives you the information, and the film really galvanizes it. So it's tomorrow evening, 7 o'clock. All the funds go to WBAI. And it's very inexpensive. Normally it would be around $100, $125. It's $49.95 so that more people can come. So here's what you do. You make a call, I'll give you the number here, and you call in, and you'll be reserved a seat as long as seats are available. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. I'll be there. It's at 86th Street in Amsterdam, and it starts at 7 o'clock. You'll be given the book, the film, watching the film, and a discussion afterwards. It's a wonderful way to spend an evening. 877-627-5065. And every single premiere I've ever done has been packed. So please make your call now. It all goes to support WBAI. Now let's go out and say hello to my guest who is standing by, Dr. Louis Melmadroni. And he is a medical physician, associate professor, Osteopathic Medicine University of New England, College of Osteopathic Medicine. And he has been a pioneer in the dialogue and integration of neuroscience and transformation processes for physical and psychological healing and health. And he's also the founding executive director of the Coyote Institute for Studies of Change and Transformation, which is an educational project which brings his research practices to a wider audience. He's the author of Remapping Your Mind. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Stories and the discipline of creating and sharing stories go back to the time when humans first started gathering to live in communities. And they've had profound effects for sustaining and holding together the fabric of tribes, communities, and even civilizations. And with the advent of modern neuroscience and our greater understanding of the mapping of the brain, how the brain processes and communicates information, we're learning that the mental activity of creating stories and then communicating them is a natural process with a unique brain signature. So first, please go through the scientific basis behind storytelling and what is unique about the process of story creation that distinguishes it from other forms of narrative and discursive reasoning and communication. And second, share the transformative processes that occur when you're retelling and also listening to a story.
Well, it turns out that what we do when we're on idle is to make up stories. And it's the default mode of the brain. It was this was discovered in St. Louis by a neuroscientist named Raichel, that when we're sitting around doing not much of anything, we're inventing stories about the people that are important to us in our lives and how to manage our relationships with them. And so it's the structures in the brain, I can name them, but they won't make a lot of sense unless you have your 3D brain app, which is one of my favorite apps. But it's the, we have the medial prefrontal cortex, the posterior cingulate gyrus, the precuneus, and parts of the temporal and parietal cortex. So these are all in the middle of the brain. And so when we're making up stories, these parts are highly active and burn less glucose than meditating. It takes a lot more effort to meditate than it does to make up story. And so there's a group of anthropologists and neuroscientists in the UK who came up with this idea called the social brain hypothesis. And their idea is that our big brains evolved as our relationships did. So we need a big brain to manage all the relationships that we can have with other people. And the way we manage those relationships is to make up stories about what these other people would do under particular circumstances or in certain contexts, or so that we're always forecasting the future, in a sense, by making plausible stories about what we think people will do. And humans can actually keep track of up to 500 people, whereas, you know, monkeys are more in the range of 50 other monkeys. So we're just incredibly more sophisticated in our story tracking capacity, which is what they say explains why we need so much more brain than monkeys do. So it's pretty exciting to find out that neuroscience is finally catching up to the Lakota people, from which an elder told me, well, that's obvious. We always knew that anything that was really important was existed in the form of a story. And I think we can all relate to that, because when we get together with someone we haven't seen in quite a while, we swap stories. We tell each other the stories of our lives. And stories are social neurotransmitters. They're the way that we share information with each other and get each other to look in the same direction. And I think Gary earlier was talking about, you know, broader cultural stories about what constitutes good government, or what constitutes, you know, right relationship between the people and their elected officials. So these are broader stories, and the various political parties are telling stories to all of us, trying to get us to step in line with their program.
Isn't it a part of all human relationships that we try to express our stories to someone so that they can understand us through the stories we tell them, accurate or inaccurate, objective or lacking objectivity? That's how people know us.
Right, and there's something really exciting called speaker-listener neurocoupling. And it turns out that if I tell a story to you, the same parts of your brain light up in you as are lit up in me in the telling of the story, but with a 6-second delay. So it's acoustic mirror neurons, so that the way we experience each other through story is that by telling a story, I cause the parts of your brain to light up in the same configuration as the parts of my brain, and therefore we come to understand each other a little better.
Okay, I remember in the 1970s there was a growing new psychological movement and a great deal of psychoanalytic experimentation. I knew a lot of these people. They were my friends: Marty Shepard, Dr. Lane Kahn, Alan Putterman, Carmi Harari. I don't know if any of those names mean anything to you, but these were the leaders of experimental psychoanalytic movements in the 1970s, and I recall one modality incorporated the art of storytelling, and when we can frame our illnesses or our disease or our mental condition we suffer from into a story, does it hold any potential to enhance the prospects of healing, or does it keep us a victim because we're not willing to change our story? If we're a victim in the story or a hero in the story, does that impact whether we're able to write a new story to reposition ourselves or stay chained to the old story?
The first step is to have a story. And the most difficult events to heal are the events that exist without story. So these are the severe traumas or the traumas that happen before children have language. And so the first step is to have a story. And, you know, I see many people who have stories in which they're the victim, in which everyone else does bad things to them and nothing good ever happens. And so, yes, we have to transform those stories in order for them to feel better. You know, we have to create stories of agency in which they become more heroic and their actions make a difference in the world. And when you feel like what you do matters in the world, that you can have an impact upon your world, then it turns out that you're more mentally healthy, and you have a tendency to do things. And when we do things, change occurs. So we have to do something. We can't just sit and do nothing, or nothing will happen. And so we work with stories in this way. We say that when people are suffering, it's not because they're defective, it's because they have not so good stories about how to interface with the world. And so therapy is replacing bad stories with better stories. And, you know, in that way, we come to suffer less.
Recently, a person approached me who was the husband of a wife with end-stage cancer. And the wife should have been dead, was not. The wife, 6 weeks after her death date, she was not just alive, but actually functioning. And the husband made an unsolicited call and said, I just want you to know that I cannot place a price on the value of having my wife with me, because now we've been recalling the stories of our marriage and our relationship for the last 35 years. I cannot tell you how important that is, because every time we talk about one of the stories from our past, it brings up joy and happiness and excitement, and that is meaningful. So even if she passes tomorrow, we will have shared those stories again, and they're still in our consciousness. And so here's a man telling me about when you're with someone, sometimes you forget the significance of stories past, of remarkable moments, of unique experiences, of times of crisis and trials, tribulations, and growth, how you survive crisis. All of us survive crisis, but we sometimes forget the significance of passing those, sharing those with other people until it's too late, until we no longer have that moment to share a story with someone. The story of love, the story of commitment, the story of empathy, the story of caring, the story of creativity. Because today we're so self-centered in our attention that our stories are about as superficial as the selfies that an entire generation is obsessed with taking. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, I think that that's really important, because the way we find meaning and connectedness and belonging with each other is to share stories. And so I know that I'm part of a group because we share the same stories. Or I know I'm part of a family because we share the same stories. And in that sharing of story, we come to know each other and to appreciate each other and to feel belongingness, to feel as though I belong here and I feel loved here. And so it's really important to honor the stories of our lives, and especially as one gets older, you know, to celebrate these wonderful memories that that exists, then we do that in by telling each other the stories that matter to us.
Well, I appreciate you being on. The website, for those of you who want more, is coyoteinstitute.us. And the latest book is Remapping Your Mind. My guest, I'll spell his name for you. It is Mehl-Madrona. He's a medical doctor and a PhD. Thank you very much for being with us today, Lewis.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Knoll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
A white sport coat.